The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you to all of our new subscribers and listeners. If there is one minor silver lining in this horrible, rainy, dark cloud that has been COVID-19, it is that we've had a huge upsurge in downloads and listens. So thank you. If you know someone who enjoys the podcast, let them know. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's program, we'll be speaking to Mike Brown, the man who killed Pluto. He has come back. And not to apologise, but to make amends, he's on the hunt for a replacement ninth planet. It's called Planet Nine. We'll be asking, where is it and when are we likely to find it? If he discovers it, it could be the biggest astronomical discovery of the century. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us on the line is Dr. Lara Dungan and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
The trial designs we have in place are very nimble. That means we can move forward faster. And again, we thank the countries who've committed to the solidarity trials in particular, but there are other trials out there which also need to be supported.
Is this strange announcement, Lara, from an ethical point of view, but obviously this is a all bets are off sort of world we're in with COVID-19. It's to do with the WHO and how they're going to try and progress treatments and possible vaccines a bit faster than normal.
It's, yeah, absolutely fascinating, Jonathan. I kind of couldn't believe when it came out, but also to me, it makes a lot of logical sense. So what's happened is the World Health Organization have said that under certain conditions that they've outlined in a long document, it will be ethically acceptable to do a thing called human challenge studies for looking at the COVID-19 vaccine. So I'll explain what that means. Traditionally, when you are creating a vaccine, there's two ways to test it. One is human challenge, which is rarer. And one is that you will vaccinate approximately 1,000 or a couple of thousand people. You'll let them go out into the world and then you'll see if they do or don't get the disease. You can imagine that's problematic and it's slow, but it's also quite safe. The other way is human challenge. And, you know, more than 50 and 100 years ago, this happened quite frequently with things like smallpox, yellow fever. But those are ethically very, very grey. But these days, we do still do human challenges where we give the actual disease to the people that have been either vaccinated or had a sham vaccine. So, for instance, we do it for influenza, rhinovirus, typhoid, cholera, malaria. So we actually do it for a lot of diseases. But these are diseases where there is a known and very good treatment. And COVID-19 does not fit into that. We don't have, bar potentially remdesivir, we don't have a good treatment that can guarantee safety for people who have been infected with the virus. We also have no idea what dose to infect people with. So we could be giving people massive doses or we could be giving them tiny doses and they're not being made sick. But the benefit is that this will massively expedite a potential vaccine. You could use maybe only 100 people, or you could have 100 people get one vaccine, 100 people get another vaccine. There's more than 100 vaccines that are trying to be produced at the moment. So you could use far, far less people and you could have it done so much faster if you then try to challenge them with the vaccine, the virus, rather than let them go out into the world. Because actually at the moment we are doing so well at reducing the amount of spread of COVID-19 that it would take a long, long time to find out whether the vaccine worked or not if you just did it the other way. So the way the World Health Organization have said it's potentially acceptable is if you fit certain criteria. So for instance, it has to be young, fit, healthy people between the age of 18 and 30. These are the kind of people that only about 1% of them are hospitalized when they have the disease and only about 0.03% are actually proved fatal. And they have to have very good informed consent. So they need to really know what they're signing up for and they need to be volunteers. So this could massively expedite the vaccine. It's ethically so fascinating, I think. It just opens up all sorts of cans of worms here. But I suppose we just have to see what happens.
It's so funny what a difference 20 years makes. That 18 to 30 bracket screams out at me as the age that Ibiza package tours were marketed at. I think there was an actual 18 to 30 group. Like back 20 years ago, 18 to 30s were being sold, pleasure cruises, and now they're being asked to submit their bodies in a not to be alarmist, but in a way that could possibly kill them, correct?
Could possibly kill them, but could save also hundreds of thousands of people. 300,000 people at plus have already died from this virus. How many will die in the time it takes to create a vaccine? We don't know. So, you know, it's just, it really is fascinating, the whole thing.
Yeah, it's hugely ethically problematic. When you're talking about giving an empty version of the virus or dead version of the virus, but actually the live virus that has killed people, when you're suggesting that you're going to do that to people, it'd be interesting to see how many volunteers they get for it.
Well, there's already a website and they have over 20,000 volunteers in only a couple of days, but most of them don't fit the criteria. But people really want to do this. They want to give up their potential health for this vaccine.
Our second story, Shane, has to do with a search of the ocean.
Yeah, it's like social distancing to a new extreme. So like this is from Western Australia, which is already quite remote, and the Western Australia Museum. And what they've done is they've gone off the coast to a bioregion, the Gascoyne coast, and they have gone below the waves 4.5 kilometers deep in a submarine that people are in, not many, I imagine, and then a remotely operated vehicle alongside it. And this voyage has discovered up to 30 potential new species of animal under the water.
Wow.
And that's pretty cool, because you'd think in the 21st century that almost everything that could be found on Earth is already found. But we continue to find new species all the time, and the ocean is one of the richest areas for discovering new species. But on their way back up, as they were resurfacing, and the scientists inside the submarine were chilling out and patting themselves on the back for a good expedition, they came across what is said to be the longest creature ever discovered, a siphonophore, which is hard to say, which is a creature like a jellyfish. And it's 45 meters long, which is incredible. That's like twice the length of your average blue whale. And this is a creature that acts as a single unit, although it's made up of units that are clones of each other. And it is a predator. Yes, I guess.
Well, maybe not. But it's not really clones. Sorry, go on.
Now I just have this image of the Borg under the water off the coast of Australia. But this thing is pretty terrifying, which is why I think it might be like the Borg. So it's 50 meters long, and it stuns its prey in the same way that jellyfish does, with long stinging tentacles that dangle from it. That paralyzes the prey, and then it starts to digest it as it rots, which is gross. And so this creature is 45 meters long, and much longer than any other creature that's ever been found. And it's a string-like creature. So
kind of has this weird spiral shape or sort of nest-type shape to it, doesn't it? It's not like a big, long, stringy snake in the water.
Yeah, so it looks like a series of concentric circles spiraling out from a center, and any creature that's unfortunate enough to come in contact with it is going to potentially get stung and eaten. And of course, the waters off Australia are notorious for stinging creatures that can kill you. Everyone will know of the box jellyfish that lives off the coast of Australia, famous for being able to stun a human and kill them instantly. So, you know, yet another reason not to go swimming off the coast of Australia.
Well, I don't know about that. If you've been there, you'll know sometimes it's just worth the risk. Depends on the day and where you are and who you're with. Our third story, Lara, has to do with fatty foods.
It does indeed. Yeah, this is a story that probably a lot of people in lockdown won't want to hear, because unfortunately most of us have diets that have gone right out the window. But research from Ohio State University has shown that meals that are high in saturated fat, so that's generally fats that come from animal sources rather than vegetable sources, have a big effect on our attention and our ability to concentrate on tasks. So they had 51 women who were coming in anyway to have a look at post-cancer survivors and their ability to retain attention. And what they did was they cooked them up a huge meal of eggs, biscuits, which is an American version of basically scones, turkey sausages and gravy. And half of them, they cooked it with an animal sourced oil, and the other half they cooked with sunflower oil. first they tested their memory in the morning, then they gave them their meal, then they tested their attention and memory 5 hours later. And what they found was that the people who had the saturated fat, the animal fat, performed 11% worse. Now, it doesn't sound like a massive amount, but remember, this is one meal. We're not talking about months and months of poor diet, which potentially a lot of people have. This is one single meal. And then they took the same people and they brought them back a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, and they switched the meal that they got. And again, consistently, they found that the people who had previously gotten sunflower oil and had done pretty well performed worse when they got the saturated fat. So it's just a little bit worrying, and just another little sign that shows us that animal fats are bad for us in, unfortunately, so many different ways, even though they taste absolutely delicious.
So, I mean, what do you make of this study? Do you think it stands up? Do you think one meal could actually make our focus and attention?
Yeah, it's a small study. It's only 51 women, and it's women only, which is also a problem. But I do think it's a pretty good study. And I think it makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that's showing that saturated fat can cause inflammation, and inflammation can have an effect on the brain, and certain types of fatty acids can cross the blood-brain barrier. So they may potentially be affecting the brain directly itself. So, I mean, I would always recommend anyway that people should reduce saturated fat to as low as they possibly can. And this is just another reason why we should have broccoli instead of steak, I'm afraid.
Shane, our final story is about how we look for things.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, it's kind of like the science of where's Wally? Or, you know that moment when you're heading to town and you're like, oh, where's my leave card? And you start freaking out because the bus is going to be in a few minutes. And if you're like me, what I do is try and remember, well, when did I have it last? And you start picturing the object in your mind. And that is known to help us locate objects. And psychologists have been interested in our ability to spot things that we're looking for and how we filter out noise in the signal that's coming into our eyes. And it's always been thought that we will just look for visual cues, as in the leap card is green, so I'm going to look for green things. Even though you may not be consciously aware that you're doing that, your brain will filter. So they've done another study in the Johns Hopkins University, and they've shown that the unseen qualities, or the things that we don't see but yet know qualities, so hardness, softness, slipperiness, this sort of stuff, that those factors, when we're aware of those, we're able to find the associated object quicker. And so to measure this, they asked people to find an object. And when they were able to describe or had a sense of what the physical attributes or qualities of that object were, they were on average able to find it 20% faster than those who didn't really know what that object felt like, or what its kind of its surface properties were like, which is kind of incredible, I think.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of an extreme example of like a bowling ball. So looking for a bowling ball in a plastic kid's ball pit, like you'd know it's at the bottom. We're not just talking about that, right? But we're talking about all of the attributes of a particular thing. Actually, knowing it well help us find it.
Absolutely. So if you're looking on top of your bed, say, and it's a big mess of stuff that you've just tipped out of a suitcase, and you're looking for the leather toiletries bag, then you look for something that has the surface properties of leather. So it'd be smooth and shiny, as opposed to all the soft things in there that your clothes are made out of. Where I would sort of question the finding a little bit is that the visual signals given off by these materials will also change. And also there's going to be, if you're talking, there's going to be an audible difference as well, as the surface properties of these materials will be different. And so like soft furnishings will not reflect sound, and they're not going to be shiny on average. So I suspect that there is still some sort of visual aspect to what you're looking for. But this paper doesn't say that visual stuff isn't important. It just says that the other qualities may be important as well. And perhaps what's interesting to disprove my point is that they say that you're able to do it in drawings as well. So that if you're looking for a soft object in a photograph, you will you'll find that if you are able to describe the qualities of that soft object, if you know what a scarf feels like, you'll be able to see it in a photograph of other objects as well.
So
where's Wally should work, you know. So if you know what Wally surface is like, so what does he wear, a stripy top, and then you're not just looking for the red and white stripy top, you're just looking for something that has like stripy top qualities.
So how did they test this?
Well, like all psychology experiments, they got people into a room and then they divided them into two groups. One group that was able to describe the physical qualities of the materials they were looking for, and one group that wasn't. And then they said that basically that's a control group, and they went from there. So I'm not a positivist, so I don't really buy into that sort of mechanism for doing science a lot of the time, but look, there is merit in it. It's just that it's always, as they would say themselves, it's not the whole picture.
Well, I'm not sure how that really helps us in the real world, but I'm sure that a psychologist would be able to tell us why that's important.
I'm sure they would.
Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Laura Dungan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Johnny.
Now, remember when you were in school and you learned there were 9 planets in the solar system? Then there was all that unpleasantness with Pluto in 2006. Well, good news. Thanks in part to our next guest, you can essentially forget that ever happened. Sort of. Mike Brown is Richard and Barbara Rosenberg Professor of Planetary Astronomy at the California Institute of Technology, also known as Caltech. And he's one of the interesting scientists at the forefront of the search for Planet Nine. He joins me now. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Last time we spoke, we were discussing your book in which you confessed to the murder of Pluto. And we should just make sure that people know that that is you, and that you were one of the people who brought about the downfall of Pluto, demoting it to dwarf planet back in 2006. Guilty as charged?
I would say that I helped Pluto find its true place in the solar system.
Yeah, you would say that, you see. So let's talk about getting us back to 9 planets. Maybe it's from a place of guilt that you have started this quest, but you are looking for this so-called 9th planet. We've talked about it on the program a bit, but maybe you might tell us what we're looking for and why we think it's there for people who haven't been listening. So where did all this thing start?
It all started from a pair of colleagues of mine were looking at the most distant objects we know in the solar system, and they noticed something funny about them. They noticed they didn't quite go around the sun the way they were expected to, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. And it took a while for we started getting involved and realized that the explanation for the strange behavior of some of these bodies, most distant bodies, is that they're all being affected by a giant planet much further out than any of the planets that we know right now. So this is something that's maybe 15 times further away from us than Neptune, and something that's maybe 6 times the mass of the Earth. So this is no small, maybe it's a planet, maybe it's not. This is the 5th largest planet in our entire solar system out there waiting to be found.
Well, you're talking with great certainty here, saying that this is the 5th largest planet, which would be huge that we've discovered something that we didn't know was there. But obviously the first question that most people are thinking is how do you miss something that big in our own solar system?
Yeah, it seems crazy, but because it's so far away, it's quite faint, and we haven't surveyed the skies with telescopes big enough to find all of the faint objects in the sky to be able to track down which one this is. So once we find it, it's not that it's individually hard to find. If you told me exactly where it was, I could point a telescope at it and know that I was looking at it, but it's just that the sky is big and we need the telescopes to do it. It's like if I showed you a grain of sand, you could easily see that grain of sand, and I threw that grain of sand onto a beach and I said, now go find it. It'd be hard to do.
This planet, it's big and it has a funny trip around the sun. What's funny about it?
It does. It's on a very elongated orbit, and that was the clue that let us realize that it exists. It comes much closer to the sun on one half of its orbit, goes much further away on the other, which is sadly, we think it's on the most distant right now. And it's also tilted by a little bit compared to the other planets in the solar system. So it's kind of torquing the entire outer part of the solar system away from round and away from tilted in the right way.
Okay, but how does a planet get into that sort of elongated orbit? Is that typical? Because ours is quite round, right? And the rest of the planets, it's quite a circular orbit.
Right, and so that's a great question. And I'll first say that we don't know how it got there. So the fact that it's there, we can tell from the gravitational influence, but that doesn't tell us anything about how it got there. Nonetheless, we have some ideas on how it probably got there. So what we think happened is that it probably formed closer to Uranus and Neptune. And in early in the solar system, there was a lot of jostling around it. And we think that it got jostled around, got a little bit too close to Jupiter or Saturn, and got flung outward to that outer part of the solar system and has been lurking out there ever since. It's not all that strange. It's strange for our solar system, but it's not all that strange for other planetary systems we see in the galaxy. We see planets of about that same size, and we see them on orbits that are elongated. We see them on orbits that are tilted with respect to each other. We have had, we thought, a very regular looking solar system, but that's actually more unusual than other things that we see.
You say you've spoken about it with great confidence. Normally physicists say what we think is, you know, they back off. You're talking about you're certain it's there. How are you speaking with such confidence?
So you know, as a scientist, I would not say I'm certain. I would say that the evidence is very strong, and we are fairly convinced that it's out there. And it's because we first started realizing that these patterns we saw in the sky could be caused by a giant planet out there about 4.5 years ago. And when we first proposed this idea 4.5 years ago, we said, look, here are some things that must be true if there really is a planet, is that we will continue to find bodies that are very distant that follow the same patterns. So this was not just a fluke we saw the first time. And that's happened. So that's a good prediction. But what also happened, which I think has been fascinating, is that as we continue to think about the existence of this planet out there, we realized that it would have other effects we hadn't thought about yet. And then when we look at the solar system, we see all those too. We see objects on other sorts of orbits that no one had previously had an explanation for that are naturally explained by this planet. So as the evidence continues to accumulate and it continues to explain more and more things that were previously inexplicable, in my mind, the solar system would be a much stranger place without this planet than with this planet. We would have to have all sorts of individual explanations for these things we see, whereas one simple explanation can explain all these other weird things. So I am pretty convinced. There's always the chance that something else will be found, or someone else will realize an alternative explanation. But in 4.5 years, that hasn't happened. So I am definitely optimistic.
But wait, you said there are other things that this planet would explain. That would give us the idea that certain phenomena happened at certain times, which means if we use triangulation, we should be able to know where the planet is now, right? I mean, why have we not found it if it's that big?
And we
know effects that it may have had on things along the way.
So the problem is the best analogy is with the discovery of Neptune. Neptune was predicted. Its location was predicted because Le Verrier was able to look at the orbit of Uranus and look at how Neptune was pulling on the orbit of Uranus. And he could look all around the whole orbit of Uranus because by the time he started looking at the data, the location of Uranus had been known for more than one full rotation around the sun of Uranus. The problem is these objects that we're looking at that are being affected by Planet Nine, we only just discovered them in the last 5-10 years, and they've hardly moved.
That's a long time ago, Mike.
Yeah, so they take like 5,000 years or 10,000 years to go around the sun. If you could give me 10,000 years to watch these objects, I could point exactly where Planet Nine was.
But what about the photographs that we've already taken? Because surely we have documented the entire sky many times over at this stage, right?
We have looked at the whole sky many times with many telescopes. But the problem is, every time you look at the whole sky with a certain telescope, you only see stars of a certain faintness. And so if you want to see even fainter stars, you have to get an even bigger telescope. And so we're just at the limit for Planet Nine of maybe it has been seen with the telescopes we've had used so far, and maybe it's just a little bit too faint. We are right now searching through all of the old data of the sky surveys with the biggest telescopes that have been done. And I am optimistic that we might find it in those data. It might just be a little too faint, but it might not. And that might be a good way to find it.
All right, so where do we go from here? We've got this idea that Planet Nine is out there. We have a rough idea of where it might be. Are we closing in on that? What's your plan to discover this? Because this would be huge, right? You'd be able to at least redeem yourself partially for killing Pluto by replacing it in a switcheroo. If you had 10 years to find out, what would you do?
Oh, so I'm hoping it doesn't take 10 years. So we have been working hard for the past 4.5 years, and we have been systematically ruling out parts of the sky. And so I keep this map in front of me that shows where it can still be and where it can't be. And as long as we can get to enough telescopes and spend enough time scanning those regions, we will rule those parts out and I think find it. If we don't find it in the next couple of years, there is a new telescope that's under construction in South America, the Vera Rubin telescope, formerly called the LSST. And it's a big telescope that's designed to scan the skies night after night after night. And if we miss it in the surveys we're doing, there's really no chance that telescope will miss it. So that's 2022, 2023, maybe 2024 at the latest. So I think we are less than half a decade away from finding this planet.
One thing that hasn't fallen out of this conversation is plurality. Like you've said, we're looking for this planet, it's this size. But if we've missed Planet Nine, what about Planet 10 and Planet 31?
Yeah, I actually think that is a really interesting question to think about. There is no reason why there can't be a 10, 11, and a 12. The difficulty is that each of those must be even further away than the one we're looking for right now. And so we don't have the telescopes to find those yet. And we don't even have the telescopes to find the really distant objects that would be being affected by that planet to even know that planet exists. So I often talk about Planet Nine to groups of kids, and I say, look, you know, Planet Nine is perfect because it's just what we can find with the telescopes now. So we are going to find Planet Nine, but Planet 10, Planet 11, that's yours. You're going to have to invent the new telescopes. You're going to have to figure out how to go find that one.
What happens if you actually find it? I mean, to add a planet to the list of planets in our solar system, not many people, I mean, no one living has gotten to do that. What would that mean to you as an astronomer?
To me, it would just be delightful, that moment where you see something that you know no one else has seen before. It's just one of the biggest charges of life. But then the next thing is not just discovering it, but getting to study it, learning about what it's made out of. Does it have moons? Does it have rings? The discovery usually gets all the play, but it's really the science that we get from it too, and what we learn about the solar system and how it put itself together. So it's just, I'm giddy with excitement about these possibilities coming sooner rather than later.
I mean, knowing what we know about these distant objects, is there any chance it's anything more than just a rocky ice ball?
I think actually it is more likely that it's a giant planet closer to being like Uranus and Neptune than it is to a big ice ball like Ganymede or like Pluto or something. Because of its size, because it's six times the mass of the Earth, when we see planets in the galaxy that are six times the mass of the Earth, those tend to be big balls of gas rather than ice balls. And yet, our ability to predict these things is not good. So I would be surprised, but not that surprised if it's something different than we expect.
Right, because I suppose the spread of those planets makes sense from a linear point of view, why Mercury is the way it is, why Neptune is the way it is. We understand that because we sort of understand the origins of those planets, but because we don't know where Planet Nine came from, it is possible that it doesn't follow the same origin story.
That is exactly right.
Well, look, it would be so exciting to think that we could add another planet to our list. Do you know what it's going to be named? Have you any idea what that's going to be?
No, I'll tell you that astronomers, certainly me, are a superstitious lot. And one of my firmly held superstitions is that if you try to think of a name before you find it, you will not find it. So okay. we have steadfastly refused to even think about what we might name it.
Mike Brown, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much. I hope to speak to you in a few years' time before you get your Nobel Prize.
All right.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye.
Okay, it's time to look back at some of your emails and texts and tweets from last week. Aidan McKelvey, producer, joins me on the line. Hi, Aidan.
How's it going?
Did I interrupt your workout again?
Yes. you're like clockwork.
I know, it's annoying.
It's like you sense something in the force. Yeah, well, disturbance in the force. Something is happening.
You used to ring me all the time during child meltdowns, and I was wondering, like, do I just have more meltdowns from my kids, or do you just, is there something, is there a ripple in time, a wrinkle in time?
I think we're just connected, Jonathan. I realized you needed, yeah. And I needed you to make me avoid doing exercise.
Yin and yang. Right. Yes. So we were talking to Lauren Salen last week. She was fantastic. She was taking us on a history of the Earth's living creatures, minus humans and minus dinosaurs, because they get so much attention. And it was really fascinating. She was talking in particular about how our ancestors, I used to have many more digits, and that actually there's a gene you can knock out in people or in any other animals that if you do it in the embryo state, you start growing extra fingers. Gordon Weston says, a friend of mine in secondary school was born with 6 digits on each hand. Gordon, did they have 6 toes as well on each foot? Because my friend has that, I think. And it was such a strange thing to see. And I'd just seen Gattaca when I met her, which is a weird one, Aidan. You'll know in Gattaca, there's a pianist who has extra fingers, and he plays a piece of music that you can't actually play unless you have 6 fingers. I was really freaked out by meeting her, but I eventually got over it, which is, you know, obviously it's just something that happens. But like, when I was like, this is weird.
Did your friend have a tum, Jonathan? Because you know the way she was saying that if you knock
really,
out the gene for
that's
a tum.
My memory, yeah. It's not my memory is she had 6 fingers on each hand, and no specific thumb.
Right. So that's what it would have been. Would have been probably that exact mutation.
Yeah, I was just thinking it was so weird that it happened at the same time. Owen Sadlier said, fantastic show, Jonathan. Lauren, fascinating stuff. The pollen traces found after the meteor crashed 160 million years ago resonated, followed by 3 sneezing emojis. Owen, obviously someone who suffers from hay fever. And Denboy Walton said, great show today. Incredible knowledge from your guest, Lauren. Wasn't she just brilliant? Like, you could ask her anything and she didn't need to pause or think about it, or she was never vague about anything. She was like, this is what happened. This is what they looked like. This is when it was. It was brilliant. We were in news. We were talking about the nearest black hole, and Floss has taken us to task. She says, lads, has the Milky Way shrunk? It's approximately 120,000 light years in diameter, not 10,000 light years. I was going to put my hands up and say I didn't know it was either of those, and that's the job of the producer to fix, I would have thought.
No, I think it was actually Shane who said it. And just to be fair to Shane, I think people who aren't speaking on radio regularly in front of, you know, thousands of people listening, it's quite easy to make a mistake. You know, he probably had notes in front of him, and without thinking, he probably read 100,000, because it's between 120,000 and 100,000 as 10,000 without sort of thinking about it. I'm sure he probably actually knows.
My favorite one of those is like one of the directors of ESA at the moment. And like, I hate bringing this up all the time, but it is funny. His name is Peter, and he is a solar physicist. And he was on our program saying that the sun went around the earth and it was live, so there's nothing you can do about it. It went out, and then he came, the microphone went off, and he went, "No!"
So it does Yeah, it does happen, because like even when you're, if you're in studio and I'm putting through a text to you, Jonathan, you're always, as a producer, you're kind of terrified that it will go full Ron Burgundy. Like most of the time it doesn't, but people do make small errors because there's a lot going on when you're on live radio that you might just not read it thoroughly and accidentally read it out on air. So I think we can cut Shane a bit of slack.
Yeah, fair enough. I think so. And like, as the person who makes so many mistakes and just kind of, they just wash over me, I do think it's fine to point them out as well. We were talking about smelling things in a coma and possibly using it as a diagnostic tool. This is Lara's story last week, that if you're in a coma and you need to be diagnosed as what sort of level of non-responsiveness you have, getting people to smell things might be a good one, because apparently if people wrinkle up their noses, if they inhale, then they are more conscious, obviously, than someone who doesn't respond at all. Jeremy says, similar research done a few years ago showing the link between smell sensitivity and dementia. It's been shown that a smell is a better trigger of memory than sight or sound. Very good. And then Veronica was talking about EOE. I'm just going to call it EOE, Aidan, because I... She says, dear Jonathan, I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and I can't inhale. It happened once in a restaurant and alarmed everyone there. It's terrifying. The last attack was a few weeks ago. Jumped out of bed and bent over, then took a tiny bit of water, which helped me to take ultra short breaths. I'm a celiac. Would be grateful to ask the doctor if you can prevent attacks, or when I do, what I should do. Veronica will absolutely get on that. And that's a horrific thing to happen to you. Look after yourself, please. There are so many small unknown conditions that we just don't even think about that completely affect that affect people's lives in such dramatic fashion. So thanks very much for that, Veronica, and look after yourself. That's it for texts and tweets. Anything? I mean, have you anything else to add, Aidan?
No, I'm gonna get back to my exercise.
You're doing your reps. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who you heard there, producing the podcast, researching with Simon Keane, on sound was Peter Malloy. We have more in your Future Proof podcast feed on Tuesday and Thursday. What are they, Aidan?
This Tuesday will be our Vampire Bats bit with Daniel Stryker.
Oh yeah, that was really interesting. Yeah. He was talking about vampire bats, his work in South America, and how he's working on a sort of contagious vaccine. Really interesting stuff. So that's on Tuesday in the podcast feed, wherever you found this. Like, subscribe, rate, and tell people about it. In the meantime, stay curious.